I'll start by thanking the community again for supporting me, being here. Very unexpected visit, and express my gratitude and appreciation. I feel really happy to be here. Yeah, so tonight is, I guess, the new moon by our monastic calendar, using the Thai calendar, lunar calendar, an ancient way to not just calculate the moon, but for our tradition, our Buddhist tradition, to observe. It's an observance. That's why it's often referred to as an observance night or an observance day. And so this afternoon, the monastic community gathered up in our communal building up in the forest, and there was the recitation of the monastic rule. So the 227 precepts of the Bhikkhu Padimokkha, then the novice, the seminar training recitation, and then the Anagarikas did what was just done a few minutes ago, the refuges and eight precepts. And this happens every fortnight. And so then on these nights in this monastery, gathering in the evening, like we're doing this very moment, chanting together, meditating together, members of either the lay residents or lay community, if they wish to request the refuges and precepts, listening to Dhamma. It's a very ancient tradition that we're living right now, this very moment. And it's available. So for some of us, it's extraordinarily meaningful. And for some of us, you know, in the world, it just doesn't mean anything. And that's just natural. That's very natural. There's, just like all of us, there's certain things that interest us and certain things that don't. And so this is our bond this evening, is interest in peace, in understanding, in kindness, liberation. Liberation from stress, from suffering, from discontent, from dis-ease. And it's a path. This is a word we've heard referred to, this practice. It's a path, and it's also been referred to as a gradual path. It takes effort, right effort. It takes dedication. It takes confidence, or often the word uses faith. It takes confidence, trust, that there is this opportunity to awaken. And so it's so multifaceted, and it's like a gem. The image I have is like a gem with just unlimited, well, not unlimited, but just so many facets. It's not just 10 or 20, but it's all these beautiful, shining opportunities and facets of this practice. We don't need to make it complicated. That might sound like it's overly complicated, but because we don't need to use each and every one. But there is the Noble Eightfold Path, and as was mentioned, of course, we chanted this evening the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma. What's understood in our tradition as being the Buddha's first teaching to other people. And we were chanting in Pali, but within that, there was a very clear laying out of the Four Noble Truths, and including the Eightfold Path, Noble Eightfold Path. And it's eightfold. It's a very, I refer to it as, it's holistic. It's not just one-sided. And meditation, mindfulness, and mind cultivation make up two of those. But there's six others that we shouldn't ignore. We can't ignore if we want to realize the peace that the Buddha realized himself and spent 45 years sharing that path with other people. He worked hard, from what we understand. He really put in effort and didn't stop teaching until his body passed away. So for those of us who are either live here or are very tuned in to what's the routines, and on, I guess, about 5 days a week, at the end of the morning gathering, 7 a.m., 7:30 a.m. gathering, there's this opportunity for somebody to offer a Dhamma reflection. Many of them famously recorded in the books, Beginning Our Day. But it says several memories. It goes down the line. I don't know how far down the line it goes, but I found yesterday, they were during the reflection yesterday morning, Ajahn Gai offered, and there were five words that stood out. I mean, it was all of these reflections I find helpful, each and every one. But five words stood out that is very much a central part of practice, in particularly my own practice these last few years. And the five words are, it's how we hold things. It's how we hold things. And so what am I referring to? Okay, we know those words. They're very simple words. And so this reflection, and I'm going to use that to sort of riff. I'm going to riff on those words and reflect on those words. And I emphasize that this is just a Dhamma reflection. This is how I'm currently using my own focus of Dhamma practice. So things, the way I'll translate the word things is experience. So experience through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and intellect, the mind. So those are our doors of that we experience the world. It all comes through those six senses. In Buddhism, there's the sixth sense, the mind. Everything we know about the world has come through those six senses. And so when I would say that it's how we hold things, it's the experiences that happen to us each and every day. And so how do we hold them? And so the difference between non-suffering and suffering is how are we holding them? So it's like the image that Ajahn Gai shared with us was, hopefully I'm not going to get any of this incorrect, and I'm open to feedback later, is that I think it was Lumpo Jandi was sharing a Dhamma teaching of, you've got a lemon. And so the sourness, it depends on how you hold it. If you're just holding it in a way where you're not getting overly embedded with sour lemon juice, it's not sour. It's not sour. Or the image that Lumpo Cha used, and I never met Lumpo Cha, but I've, like most of us, read his books and heard his Dhamma talks translated. He said, apparently, he famously said once to a group of monks, he says, is that boulder, is that rock, is it heavy? And I gather it was quite a big rock. And, oh yeah, it's heavy. He said, well, only if you pick it up, only if you try to pick it up, is it heavy? So there's many images that we can use, either to leave things be, or how you hold it. How you hold, like, for instance, and it's probably the same here, I can't remember, but certain trees near where my mother lives in Marin County, and it has a very prickly coating to some sort of nut inside, and then that falls on the ground. And I remember as a kid, we used to pick them up and collect them, and they're really prickly. But only if you, is how you hold it. I could get them home if I held them appropriately with just the right amount of pressure. And so in spiritual practice, often, saying, we need to let go, we shouldn't cling, we shouldn't grasp, and that's all correct. But I don't remember it saying you shouldn't hold appropriate. Hold on to the things that are worthy of holding on to, things that are beneficial, supportive, that lead to peace, lead to kindness, lead to all the qualities, the human qualities that are noble, and so that we hold on. It's not just free floating through life, whatever. I'll just, I'm a free spirit. I'll just kind of follow my kind of inclinations and things, and that's kind of has its beauty in a way, I suppose. But, if we don't have some, this is my opinion in the way I've learned Dhamma, we need containers of, like, for instance, the Dhamma teachings, the containers of the precepts. So this evening, many of you requested the refuges and precepts, and for us, the monastic community, living with our precepts. This is, I like to use the word, it's a container. It gives us a way of really seeing, bumping up against desire, but a container of goodness to really guide us. There's many ways of looking at it, to allow us to live in a way that is a benefit to ourselves, a benefit to others, that doesn't generate bad karma. You know, if we're living, you know, with the precepts, if we really live it, and we're not going to generate bad karma. It's really difficult, and then we're living at peace. We're living without regret, without remorse, and then we're able to practice Dhamma in a way that we can see more clearly things that are more hidden, things that are deeper in our mind and heart. If we're living with a lot of remorse and regret, a lot of confusion in our life, we're going to see the surface things. We're going to see the really obvious suffering, the really obvious what's referred to as defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. But the subtle, more deeply embedded things, there's a really good chance that they will go unnoticed. It's a bit like if you have a pond or a small lake or a lake, and it's really windy, or it's really, the water is choppy for some reason, you're not going to see very deeply into that water. You might not see anything. You would just see maybe reflection on the surface of the water, all these different angles of the water. You won't see deeply because there's too much turbulence. But we've all probably seen calm water, still water, and it becomes clear. The sediment settles usually, and everything settled down. Not always, but water will clear, and then you start to see deeply into that because of this, the tranquility, the calmness. And so, using our life in a way that induces as much calm as possible, as we've been doing this evening, practicing meditation, we've all got a meditation practice, then we can see clearly the things that are binding us to stress, the things that are those habits of mind, habits of heart that create this, where we are, we're picking up the rock, and we're pushing too many lemons in our mouth instead of learning how to hold these things appropriate. And sometimes we should hang on tight. You know, it's like I use the image of a ladder. You know, it's the higher you go up the ladder, the tighter we should hang on to the rungs. But we also know that to go anywhere, we need to let go. We grip tight, let go. Grip tight, let go. We have to know when to grip and when to let go. And I think that's an image, at least for me, that there's some things, like, for instance, if somebody pressurizes me to break a precept or something, which fortunately has never happened in my life, but I would hang on pretty tight. I know somebody once said, well, that means you're clinging, you're grasping. But yeah, these precepts are... they're a good thing to hold on to. It's appropriate to hold on to them. But even in the Buddha's time, some of the precepts, you know, it's very clear you shouldn't do this. But then he says, unless this is happening, then you can do it. So even there were examples where the Buddha said, no, there's certain times to give way to a precept, which is very clear you shouldn't do it. But if this is happening, you can do it. There's not many of those, by the way. So don't misinterpret that. But having these containers, these frameworks of the Dhamma Vinaya, the teachings and the discipline, the framework of ethical conduct for the monastic community, in particularly the bhikkhu form, has so many things which then most of the rules don't have an ethical content at all. Nothing ethical. There's nothing unethical about eating dinner. There's nothing unethical about most of our rules. But all of the ethical rules are in there. And it is a framework, and it's something that is utilized, has been utilized for 2,500 years, the Bhikkhu, Bhikkhuni, Sila Dara precepts, Samanera precepts, and of course the 8 and 5 precepts. So how, you know, it's how we hold things. How we hold things. How do we hold our life? How do we hold every aspect of our life? And that doesn't mean we need to go around in a tight way, asking that question, everything we do, how am I holding it, how am I holding it? No, I mean, it's to be at ease, to know when there is, this is why, in the Four Noble Truths, the first noble truth is just to understand that there is dukkha. And that's not just understanding that it exists in the universe, but, you know, is it present in this very moment, to understand both. You know, is there dukkha or no dukkha? The Buddha famously said, you know, to know when it's present, to know when that stress, discontent, disease. And then another main way of looking at dukkha, another quite different, is that just to know the unsatisfactoriness of all things. So even the most pleasant things, because another translation of the word dukkha is pain, painful, unpleasant, but even pleasant things are dukkha in the sense that they are unsatisfactory. They are, because of their ephemeral quality, their transient, temporary nature, they can't be fully satisfying because of their temporary. So we need to understand that as that first noble truth, that there, to understand. So that's the Buddha's teaching on that. And the three aspects is that, you know, dukkha should be understood to really see it. And then the second noble truth, to really see the cause of it. What are we hanging on to? You know, it goes through it. It's all around thirsting, craving, that clinging to desire, unwholesome desire. There is such a thing as wholesome desire. So we shouldn't make an enemy out of desire. But we need to know, we really need to know the difference between something being wholesome and unwholesome. The desire, for, you know, the wish for good things to be, the wish for other people, compassion and gladness at the good fortune of others, and to wish people well, to help. These are all wholesome desires. But where we get, well, one of the ways, many ways we get snagged with desire, wholesome desire, is basing our well-being on getting the results we want from our desires, fulfilling our desires. Can we be at peace, you know, when we put in effort and all of that? Can we be disappointed? Can we, maybe even when things are really painful, you know, how are we holding pain? You know, just because we are practicing Dhamma, and just because even realized what we understand. I mean, I'm working on all of this. I'm on the path. I haven't completed the path, okay? So that's for sure. And so, but, you know, when you understand from people who are really, have really tread the path, you know, there's unpleasant things happen. It's not that just life all of a sudden becomes one big pleasant experience. And if we're just trying to live moment by moment, having pleasantness, you know, is that possible? No. The Buddha experienced unpleasant things in his life as the Buddha. Having your cousin try to kill you, I think it was 6 or 7 times, was probably not a pleasant experience. I don't think the Buddha was saying, it's all good. Maybe, but shouldn't second guess the Buddha. And the Buddha experienced unpleasant things in his life, but what we understand is that he knew how to hold it. It's how he held it. It's how he experienced it. And the awakened beings, the people that really, really developed the path, you know, whether pleasant or unpleasant. And so one of the phrases that Lumpur Cha, here again, that I've read or heard reflected on by some of my teachers, is liking and disliking have equal value. Liking and disliking have equal value. So the way I understand that and reflect on it, which is hopefully useful, is that, in terms of Dhamma, to like something, liking comes and goes. It comes and goes. We experience something, we like it. It's an experience. It's a response to stimulus, and we find it pleasant. We like it, and it's temporary. It's ephemeral. It's impermanent, and it fades away. It is arisen. It is lingered, and it ceased in consciousness, in our field of consciousness. Disliking what's not wanted, what's unpleasant. It's arisen because of causes and conditions. It's arrived, whatever that stimulus was. It's unpleasant, and it lingered for however long, and then it fades away, comes and goes, temporary, impermanent. How many times have we experienced the same stimulus on different occasions, and sometimes we've liked it and sometimes we've not liked it? So that's interesting, isn't it? It's very simple, but it's not rocket science. But I think we've all had that, where it's just not the right time. It's just, maybe even the same, no, not now. This is not what I want now. So it becomes an unpleasant thing, whereas we wanted it 2 hours ago, or we'd like it to happen in a couple of hours, maybe even not that far away. And so it's the same, the very same experience can be experienced as either pleasant or unpleasant, painful or pleasurable, liking and disliking. Or when you have two or three people sitting together and experiencing the same thing, and some people are really strongly affected by it in a negative way, and other people are like, this is great. So what I'm pointing to is probably pretty obvious, is that it's not the experience, it's how you're holding the experience. It points right back to that. It's our own desire. That's why the second noble truth is that dukkha is caused by craving, unwholesome desire. We're craving something either through the six senses, through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or intellect, or we're craving to be something, to be seen as something, to acquire some sort of status, and there's quite a long list, or the opposite of that is to get rid of how we are, how we, maybe our habits, our habitual way of being, how we see ourselves, how other people see ourselves, the pushing away of experience, the pushing away of where we are, what we're surrounded with, are just to name a few. So can we experience life, experience, go through our minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years? Definitely trying to shape our life. It's not a just, become a sort of doormat to life and just let life happen, but no, to add shape. And this is right effort. And this, to bring into being wholesome things, to nourish things, wholesome things that are already there, to edge things out, to abandon things that are in our lives that are, if we can abandon those things that are unwholesome or to keep them from arising. And this is the classical, crucial formula of right effort that the Buddha laid out. Shape our lives, use the forms, like the precepts, if we're interested in that, like we are here, to use the form of the precepts, to use the form of Dhamma, to put in effort, to make, it's like, look at all the effort. You might not see it, but I think I'm probably preaching to the choir here a little bit, is that you've all been here at least for a short while and see how much effort goes into just maintaining this wonderful monastery. Takes effort, the different protocols and things, these are really good, and these are part of our toolbox to creating an environment which is supremely, in my opinion, supremely conducive to Dhamma practice, and it's available to all people. And so, yeah, put in effort. Put in effort. But that's not the goal. The goal is to not have it's goal with a small g to keep the Dhamma hall clean and keep the monastery neat and tidy and repaired and all of that. That's a small goal, but the goal is liberation. The goal is this inner freedom. And so we use the small goals as our tools to realize the ending of suffering, to realize the peace that the Buddha, you know, shared. No, and he couldn't do it for us. That's really clear. It's DIY. It's do it yourself in terms of, you know, we need to utilize the teachings up to us. And we've got the opportunity and all of us have the good fortune, you know, to have encountered this and have the peace around us. I mean, you know, there's parts of the world right now, they're not sitting in a peaceful hall listening to Dhamma. Meditating. You know, if you're dodging bombs and you're fleeing persecution and on the long list of horrible things that are happening this very moment, we're very fortunate and we should not take it for granted. I don't mean to throw a wet blanket on on life, but we should really not take it for granted. 3 years ago, there were Buddhist monks living in the Ukraine. Right, I think they've all left. There weren't many. Maybe they've gone back. I don't know. Yeah. So, to not in a heavy way, but just to say, to really recognize that we do have this opportunity, and we take it as far as we want, you know, and put in as much effort as we can. And just to summarize, this, you know, it's how we hold things. How do we hold our Dhamma practice? Are we holding too tight? Are we holding? Are we not holding tight enough? Like, you know, if we sometimes, I think this happens everywhere. Obviously, you know, maybe a little bird flies into a room. Maybe if doors are left open too long, bird gets in. And you know, how do we capture that bird so that you know it's alive and we can keep it well and get it out unscathed? Maybe a little bit scared. And, you know, we have to, I usually get a towel, just gently have to just get it, you know, hopefully just the right, hold it just right so it doesn't, can't fly out of the gap in the towel, but yet not hurt it, not damage it. See, you using our discernment and our experience and how tightly to hold, and to let it go. Or like the image of climbing a ladder. Of course, I'm using quite mundane things, but I don't know if I imagine the monastery here still has this old super long ladder. I remember when we bought it years ago, and it's super long and it's super tall. And I remember being asked to go up it once, and you better believe I was hanging on tight, you know, white knuckles by the time I got 2/3 of the way up. Now here again, this is a very mundane example, but yeah, you use your discernment. You know, if I'm just going up two steps on a little ladder, I don't do that. So we know what's what. We know what's appropriate when we're dealing with people. We know, you know, when it becomes more serious, more crucial. Yeah, and using the sensitivity of our mindfulness and our discernment, our wisdom to also how to hold the Dhamma. Are we grasping at the Dhamma? Are we grasping and say, well, no, I'm only going to follow the, I guess now it's usually got letters, different EBTs, the early Buddhist teachings. I'm not going to only read that. Okay, fair enough. That's our choice. Or am I going to be more open? By the way, I'm not criticizing the early Buddhist teachings. I use them every day. But am I going to cling to, you know, or say like with the ancient, you know, our ancient scriptures, the rules? Well, anything outside of the Vibhanga, I'm not going to pay any attention. I've heard people, monks say that. And yeah, well, there's also 2,500 years of experience that we can maybe learn from. So, you know, just to really, you know, ponder and consult and listen to people that we're living with or maybe not. Other people, to learn from each other, And so are we clinging? Because we can also cling to Dhamma Vinaya, to the Dhamma, to the teachings and the rules in ways that maybe are quote-unquote right, but they might be limiting or unnecessarily limiting. And so this is maybe an example of, you know, how are we holding things? Or during the winter retreat, I was pondering aspects of Dhamma. I was really, really going through the Eightfold Path, just really reflecting on it. Just that was my main focus, and not just living it, but really, and also listening to a lot of Dhamma talks around it and doing some reading. And I wanted to look up one aspect of the Eightfold Path, so I typed it into the internet browser, and some Dhamma forums popped up. And so I went on to a couple of Dhamma forums, which I don't normally do. And I was really, really kind of surprised. I've seen people arguing and even using wrong speech, kind of criticizing each other and kind of, well, you don't know what you're talking about and all this stuff. And I see heads in the room now going, yeah, it's like that. And I know I mentioned this at Chitters, and other monks were like going, yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? People even, you know, kind of trashing each other. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. You know, using Dhamma as a weapon, or using what, you know, some, what you think is knowledge. I would say that that's maybe they should look at how they're holding it and take a look at that. And so, and make sure that we're not doing the same thing. So if we're pointing, if I do that, even this very evening, and so I can point a finger at Dhamma forums and say, no, they're doing this. And then we always need to remember that when we're pointing a finger, that we've got three fingers pointing back to us. And that's not to say that we should be blaming ourselves, but we should be looking at least. Make sure that we're not doing the very thing that we're criticizing. And so how are we holding it? How are we holding our own understanding of things? How are we holding our Dhamma practice? How am I holding this responsibility of offering some words tonight? Am I putting something out there which is that I'm clinging to? And that's where we're using our mindfulness. This is another aspect of, it's a very important aspect of our mindfulness, to see how are we holding things. So I offered this in the spirit of just, as I said at the beginning, and just as a Dhamma reflection. And if I've said anything that's inaccurate or correct, I'm always open to feedback. But if I've offered, you know, this in the, as an opportunity for us to reflect on this and to see if some of it is useful, if it's not, just you can just gently let it go. Okay, so I'll close here.